Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. On today's show, The War That Never Dies. You know, the one based on slavery and treason and yet somehow still depicted all too often as a conflict about fuzzy notions of states' rights. The Civil War left 620,000 Americans dead and freed millions of enslaved people in the South, but the aftermath of the past century and a half is a false narrative controlled by the losing side. Beyond the horrors of systemic racism, Jim Crowism, and mass incarceration, all vestiges of unacknowledged history, we continue to live in a Confederate-drenched region. Several tragedies driven by racial hatred have caused a day of reckoning for long-accepted Southern symbols and monuments, the Charleston Church Massacre in 2015, Charlottesville in 2017, and last year, the death of George Floyd. Few people, if any, better understand how we collectively deluded ourselves into denial and ignorance than UNC Charlotte historian Dr. Karen Cox. Dr. Cox is the author of a book that skillfully strips away the myths of the Confederacy's lost cause while examining what it will take to overcome entrenched opposition to portraying our history in an accurate manner. Her book is No Common Ground, Confederate Monuments and the Ongoing Fight for Racial Justice. In light of last week's removal of one of the more central monuments in this debate, the statue of General Robert E. Lee in Richmond, Virginia, we wanted to revisit our conversation to add context to the news. Later in the program, we'll hear from a key figure in her book, former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt. But first, we start with Dr. Karen Cox. Our conversation originally aired in April of this year. Karen Cox, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So, Dr. Cox, let's start with the basics. For anyone who has doubts about the defining issue of the Civil War, what was it?
Slavery.
I just want to get that on the table.
Yeah, everyone say it with me, slavery.
In the book, and just before we came on air, you alluded to this a little bit too. You write about being dragged back into the subject of monuments and memorials again. Why have we all failed so spectacularly to confront this legacy of the Civil War and move past it? I mean, this is the 160th anniversary of the start of the war. Why are we still struggling with this?
In simple terms, the lost cause, which is this mythological narrative that emerged immediately after the war ended in the South. And basically a mythological narrative about what was, you know, why the Confederacy fought. It was over states' rights. You strip what these soldiers had fought for. You say, oh, it's not about slavery. They couldn't have possibly fought about slavery. And then what also emerges are military leaders who are only noble Christian soldiers. And the cause is always presented as a just cause or a sacred cause. And so that began immediately after the war. And then what you've seen is, like, generation after generation, this is being taught to children and through their textbooks in the schools, and to the point that you can hear people today say, no, the war was about states' rights, not slavery. So it's really this powerful mythological narrative that just really has a grasp on a lot of people.
And apparently it has a grasp on you. It will not let you go.
Yeah, well, it's me battling it.
No, I know. Right? Yeah, right.
It's my own battle, right, against this, and trying to bring forth the truth about the history, not only about the Civil War, but really the history about these monuments.
I want to share some figures with our audience that you know well. According to data compiled by the Southern Poverty Law Center, in 2020, mostly after the death of George Floyd, 94 Confederate monuments came down. I think there were 54 taken down in the 5 years before that. So that shows you some of the momentum that occurred after that horrible event in Minnesota. In all, there were 168 monuments and memorials removed last year, including 24 here in North Carolina. I'm curious for your perspective on whether you think that momentum is sustainable. And as part of your answer, Can you help us sort out the difference between monuments and memorials?
Okay, so let's start with that last part. Memorials are not necessarily monuments. Memorials could be street names, they could be markers, etc. But all monuments are memorials. Okay. They're a type of memorial. And so the momentum, such as it is,
right?
the reality is that we see this pattern since 2015 in the Charleston massacre, which is a really horrible, violent tragedy takes place. There's some talk about it. There's some removal, and then it calms down. Charlottesville, same thing. Heather Heyer was run over and killed. There was a lot of violence in Charlottesville, and then there were additional removals, and then it dies down again. And then most recently, the George Floyd murder, in which Black Lives Matter protests erupted all over the world. But in the South, they took aim at Confederate monuments. The problem is that what stops any momentum are monument laws that have been put on the books since 2015. What happened in Virginia last year was that with a change in changing of the guard in the state legislature in Virginia, the law changed and returned local control. And so that's why you've seen several more monuments being removed in Virginia. Most of those are there. Among the numbers that you quoted, it's just really honestly a small percentage of monuments. We're talking about the fact that 750 to 800 monuments had existed. Of that number, maybe just 100 have been removed. It's amazing the Confederate memorial landscape is we're just saturated with these symbols and markers and monuments. Monuments are just one aspect of that.
Yeah, and there's you're quoted in a recent story in National Geographic about this same subject. And I don't know if you've seen the actual magazine yet, but there are some graphics in there of monuments, memorials, street names. I mean, it's like looking at an entire universe, to your point, of how many of these things there are.
Yeah, it is. There wouldn't be anywhere you could turn in your community and not see evidence of Confederate memory, whether it's, the street name in Charlotte, Stonewall, battle flags, names of schools, it goes on and on.
I want to ask you, Dr. Cox, No Common Ground, you obviously are digging into the origin story of how we got here. And you have two groups that you write a lot about, the United Daughters of the Confederacy and the Sons of Confederate Veterans, both who have played prominent roles in the funding and building of monuments and memorials, as well as the building of the Confederate mythology that you just described. How and why did each of these groups approach those roles?
Well, it's primarily the United Daughters of the Confederacy, and women in general. Southern women are the drivers behind monuments from the get-go. The Ladies Memorial Associations put the first one, monuments in cemeteries, and then 30 years after the war, it's a new generation of women. And it's an interesting time. And so this organization, the UDC, was instrumental in not only, and the way I see it is crafting an entire culture around the Confederacy and white supremacy through monument building, through history, pro-Confederate histories, through education of young children. And these women felt like that this was like, an important role that they had to play as an extension of their role as women who are sort of, responsible for, raising children and what the next generation looks like. There's also a real sense that they need to honor their ancestors and kind of erase the stain of defeat and erase the stain of slavery. So this is part of the driving force behind it. What we see more recently is the Sons of Confederate Veterans have stepped into the role of defending these symbols, but even more radical groups like the League of the South, which was formed in 1994, but there are other groups doing this as well, more like white nationalist groups that are co-opting the Confederate battle flag.
You go into so many aspects of the United Daughters of the Confederacy. But one of the things that really fascinated me was the portions on how they went into education. You alluded to this earlier, what people are taught, and how they were bringing in battle flags. They were bringing in busts of the generals. They were helping with lesson plans. I mean, this was not sort of seat of your pants. Hey, it would be nice if we did this. This was very coordinated from the way that you tell this story.
Yeah, it's a, you know, a systematic approach, and it's they cast a broad, you know, net, and they were saying, okay, you know, they take their role seriously where it comes to white Southern children. And so, yes, they are placing battle flags, Confederate flags of all types in the schools. They've got portraits of Confederate leaders in the schools. They, you know, they use the monument as a teaching tool. They formed a group called the Children of the Confederacy. I mean, they really don't miss anything here. And I think it's that plus monitoring the kinds of textbooks that children learn from is what continue to raise children in these ideas around states' rights and white supremacy.
That is the voice of Dr. Karen Kost. Again, she is discussing her new book, No Common Ground, with us. We're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to hear perspective from former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt, who plays a large role in Dr. Cox's book. And then we're going to come back with more from her. This is Charlotte Talks. Stay with us.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
We're back on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eric Spanberg. More with Dr. Karen Cox about her book, No Common Ground, about the meaning of Confederate monuments, in just a moment. But first, one of the central figures in No Common Ground is former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gantt, who served two terms in the 1980s and was the city's first Black mayor. Mayor Gantt understands the pain and damage inflicted by the Lost Cause myth as well as anyone. He grew up in Charleston, where the Civil War began at nearby Fort Sumter. And in his political life, Gantt confronted divisive Confederate symbols and vestiges of white supremacy on multiple occasions. And he joins us now from his home in Charlotte. Mayor Gantt, welcome back to Charlotte Talks.
Eric, it's good to be with you again.
So, as I mentioned in Professor Cox's new book, she tells the story of a controversy in 1977 over a local monument to Confederate soldiers. Now, at that time, you were a young city councilman. You were also the only Black member of city council at that time. What happened?
Oh, my goodness. If you're going to ask that kind of question, I could go for days answering it. Let me just put it this way. Apparently, there was a little bit of miscommunication, but I don't remember the name of the gentleman that came forward. I think a Mr. Walker.
Larry Walker.
Larry Walker came forward and got permission from the city manager or assistant city manager at that time, Paul Bobo, with no objections from at least three council members that he had been in contact with, that a monument that his group wanted to place on the front lawn of the city hall honoring the Confederacy would be allowable. And he proceeded to get the approval from the city manager's office to do this. The bottom line is that they got approval, or thought they had approval. And the first time it came before city council was just prior to the dedication of the monument. And I guess I said, wait a minute, guys. I've got some concerns about, first of all, who approved it? And notwithstanding what may have occurred, I want to say something about it, because I think a Confederate monument in 1977 does not best represent the citizens of Charlotte. Bottom line, I objected strongly. The council voted almost unanimously, without my vote, consent, on a second hearing on the monument. During that period, it created quite a, I don't want to call it a firestorm, but an interesting period in which the discussion of the Confederate monument in the front of City Hall took front page. And there were citizens who did not understand my objection. There were other citizens who obviously the people who sponsored this event understood what they why they wanted the monument. They felt that there needed to be some symbolic reference to it. Charlotte didn't have anything as prominent in its current situation at that time. And this would remember a cause that they fought. They thought many men, many people gave their lives for. I simply wanted to present a differing viewpoint, which was that the Civil War was fought not as a war for states' rights. I did not see it as a lost cause. Had the Confederates won the Civil War, I might still be in slavery. And the war was not fought as a battle for states' rights. It was in fact fought to preserve slavery. Obviously, I would object to that. I would not begin to think about glorifying or putting a monument on, with my consent, in front of City Hall. That would have rendered my status at that time as one of being a slave.
First of all, Harvey, Mayor Gant, your memory is spot on, because I went through the transcripts this week of those two meetings in May of 1977. And one of the interesting things that occurred is, as you say, you brought this issue up and said, hey, wait a minute, what's happening here? Some members of council began to waffle a bit. There was some finger pointing, who's doing what? And then, as you say, it wound up in a near unanimous vote. You were the only vote in opposition. Did that surprise you? I know this is a long time ago, but do you remember whether you were surprised that you were the only no vote on this matter?
Well, to be frank with you, I got to keep putting myself back in the context of 1977 as opposed to now. I think I understood why some folks, or why most of the council, went the other way. 1977 was an election year for the council. It was also a year, I think, that we were putting on the ballot for the first time district representation. I also think that it was a time when people were concerned that the majority of folks in Charlotte had less than 20% of its population, was probably African-American at that time, that the majority of people in Charlotte were going to favor this lost cause monument. They felt probably politically that they couldn't go against it because they would be singled out in the upcoming election. That's the only thing. I sense that there were at least two or three members of the council that were very sympathetic to what I was talking about and certainly knew that what was projected as the lost cause was in fact based on a set of lies. Well, the whole cause was a fraud in my mind's eye, and I had to speak to what I had learned early on as a student and as a student in high school and all the stuff that I'd read since, that I was standing on morally correct ground by objecting to a monument that would be an insult to over 90,000 African-American citizens and many white citizens who lived in Charlotte.
You mentioned what you learned in high school. I believe you told Professor Cox, and you may have said this elsewhere, that growing up in a segregated society and by going to African-American schools, the version of the Civil War that you learned was very different than what your white counterparts were learning.
Very much so. Even our textbooks told us that it was called the War Between the States, and it was projected as a war dealing primarily with the rights of the Southern states to, in fact, conduct their affairs like they wanted to. It never was projected as a war over slavery. Never. But you cannot help coming to the conclusion that a whole lot of people grew up on the notion that the South was wronged by the North, that it was their states' rights that were trampled upon. But when you examine what right were they trying to hold on to that would cause the loss of over 600,000 soldiers in a war like that, it was the right to retain slavery, which was the basis for the economic system that the country actually had depended on for a long time.
You mentioned, Mayor Gant, the echoes to today. We're talking about events from almost 50 years ago. And of course, when you talk about the war itself, we're talking 160 years ago. As I was going through the transcripts of those meetings at the Charlotte City Council in May of 1977, there are multiple examples of denying history. One gentleman named Harry Simmons said that night, quote, "I am tired of hearing about slavery in the South." I mean, what do you make of that?
That's a remarkable statement. Slavery in the South is largely responsible for why this country is the way it is today. And it has haunted us like a cancer in someone's body. It has haunted us to this very day. It brought about ultimately the end of slavery, but in fact, the requirement for the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment, and then the Reconstruction period that didn't go very well, and then the period of Jim Crowism and lynching and terrorism, right on through to the civil rights movement of the 40s and the 50s, and even through to today, the histories of mass incarceration, poor education, poor schools, all of that came as a result of the fact that a group of people came to this country, maybe intended to be indentured servants. Many of them became slaves, and ultimately that has haunted the founding of this country for all these years. To say that slavery, why are we bringing up slavery all the time? My God, it's the basis for why America is America and the way it is today.
I want to read to you the inscription on the memorial that ultimately went in front of what is now Old City Hall. And it says, quote, "Mecklenburg County remembers with honor her gallant sons who fought in the armies of the Confederate States with the other brave soldiers of the South. They struggled nobly for the cause of independence and constitutional self-government. Their heroic deeds will be forever honored by patriotic men and women." What do you make of those words almost 50 years later?
Misguided, misunderstood. I really think that they represent an understanding of history that's not shared by all men and women who lived in the South 50 years ago and even today. They ignored a whole group of folks, myself included, who are Southerners, who had a different view. And if people want to honor their dead, that's their right. To honor it in a public place, supported by a citizenry of great diversity, and an honor that makes heroes of folks who wanted to subjugate a good portion of that population way back then, is the wrong thing to do. And I don't know how you can slice that any other way.
I want to ask you about two other aspects of this. The first is when the debate was going on, as you may remember, in 1977, what a lot of people said who were in favor of this monument being installed was the city has recently approved a monument to Martin Luther King Jr. So why would there be a problem for a Confederate monument to be erected? In other words, it was almost, hey, you have your monument, I'll have my monument. I know this seems painfully obvious to many people, but for those maybe who don't recognize the difference, what is the obvious contrast here of why those two things are not equivalent?
It's a false equivalency. It really is. The monument erected in Marshall Park, in a public park, was approved by the city council as they were seeking approval for the Confederate monument. The difference is substantially, Martin Luther King was talking about an America that was going to be inclusive of all citizens. All of us can be proud of his doctrine of nonviolence and his efforts to bring first-class citizenship to all Americans, including Black citizens, including the 90 to 100,000 Black citizens that lived in Charlotte at that time. It did not denigrate a single white citizen, and therefore it should never have been considered as a monument for Black people. It was a monument honoring a man who wanted to bring us all together. Contrast that with the very words you just described on the monument for the Confederate soldier. It only talked about the honor it brought to a segment of citizens. That's where the difference is. To equate the two, I never thought of Martin Luther King's monument as a monument for colored folks or Black people.
And here's where the story stands now, Mayor Gant. In 2015, a white supremacist murdered 9 members at a Bible study in Charleston's Mother Emanuel Church. All of the victims were African-Americans, including a local librarian named Cynthia Graham Hurd, whose brother Malcolm Graham is a current Charlotte City Councilman and a political protege of yours. That tragedy led to someone spray painting the word racist on the Charlotte monument that was installed in 1977. The city had the monument removed for cleaning and after that reinstalled it at a local cemetery rather than at the old city hall. Was that the right decision? Is that ultimately where this monument belongs, if it belongs anywhere?
Monuments like that belong in history settings. You might want to call a cemetery a place where there's history reflected. It does not belong in the public square. It really does not belong in the public square. If I go back to the first part of your question, where are we now? We are still fighting this battle. The essence of Karen Cox's book is that, in fact, we have not found common ground yet, and there is a lot of work for us to do. If I think about the basis for why Confederate monuments went up beginning in the late 19th century and early 20th century, it was the way that those who were white citizens felt about the loss of their loved ones in a cause that they thought was noble, on a history that they thought was justifiable. And I think of today, the conflict still evolves around the fact that the same truth, let me put this way, a new word that's come into the lexicon these days is the alternative truth sways the day. The people who stormed the Capitol on the 6th of January believe substantially that an election was stolen from them. The majority of people in this country did not think so. But those who believe that alternative truth fight very hard to justify their beliefs. And that's exactly what's happened with the Confederate monument story. They believed one thing. The reality is something else really occurred. And they cannot justify it as something that is honorable and something that ought to be held up and worshiped by all Americans.
And I think what you're saying, Mayor Gant, is we need to preach the actual history. What happened? We still need to reckon with the actual history of this.
We need to find our way to the truth. The truth. There's only one true thing that happened. All the interpretations, all the revisionist history that goes on has distorted substantially the outlook and perceptions of a whole lot of people in this country.
Mayor Gant, thank you so much for joining us today on Charlotte Talks.
Enjoy being with you, Eric.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll hear more from historian Dr. Karen Cox about her book, No Common Ground. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we just heard from former Charlotte Mayor Harvey Gant. He is a big part of Dr. Karen Cox's new book, No Common Ground. Dr. Cox, you've dedicated decades to studying Confederate monuments. What drew you to the story of Harvey Gant in particular?
When I read, as I was doing my research for the book, and can I just say, first of all, what a powerful interview that was. It nearly brought me to tears. I think it did bring me to tears. I think what drew me to it is his example tells the story of what it meant for African Americans to be representatives of their communities in the years after the Voting Rights Act. And he was so powerful in it. And you read the minutes and you hear how eloquent he was then and he is now about what these things mean. It was just too powerful of a story to ignore. And I felt like he encapsulated what things looked like and the possibilities and the hope that he represented for the Black community in the South. And you know, how courageous it was for him to stand up to people in 1977 and say what he said and say it so clearly. And you can tell that he was powerful because of the way people backpedaled on him in those meetings. They were clearly ashamed of themselves, but for political expediency, they voted unanimously, except for Harvey Gantt, to approve that monument.
One of the things that I think you do really well in No Common Ground is you articulate one, that African-American protests and backlash to Confederate monuments did not just start in 2015 or 2017 or 2020.
Right.
And secondly, the reason they began to gain some momentum is simply because you have a segment of the population that finally has political rights. But can you just expand a little bit on that idea?
Sure. I think there's this misunderstanding that protests have only begun since, 2015, after the Charleston massacre. And the reality is there's this longer history that goes all the way back to the 19th century in terms of how African-Americans perceive these monuments. There's been a constant critique and sometimes vandalism in early periods. The critique, Frederick Douglass called them monuments of folly. W.E.B. Du Bois, who was the leading Black intellectual of the 20th century, said, a better inscription on these monuments would be to honor men who sought to perpetuate slavery. Black Southerners wrote to the Chicago Defender, which was a national Black newspaper, and expressed their disdain and said, why are we honoring these traitors? It's just antithetical to what the Civil War had been all about. And then, of course, during the Civil Rights Movement, there are protests that are directed at Confederate monuments. And then it is so powerful when the Voting Rights Act is passed that they can elect people to power like Harvey Gantt and have their point of view expressed. But what we've seen since the gutting of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, where voter suppression is on the rise. And so it's actually taking back rights from African-American voters and the ability to elect representatives that are going to stand up for their point of view on any number of issues, Confederate monuments being the least of them. But, if you can't elect someone to office that looks like you and represents your point of view, you're essentially disfranchised.
I want to read to you a message from a listener. This is from Jay, who emails us, and he says, I've noticed quite a few Confederate battle flags being flown beside interstates and highways here in North Carolina. I think they are on private property. What's going on there? Is this just individuals or is this an organized group?
It could be a combination of both. There are individuals who do this, and then there are groups of people. I think there's a group in Morganton that flies a battle flag the size of those that sometimes fly over car dealerships. and it's also a reminder to people who are driving down that there are still individuals who cling to these values.
Let me ask you a little bit about immediate current events, even since you wrote the book.
I know.
because it really is hard to keep track of. Let's start with you were on this show in January. We discussed the Legacy Commission here in Charlotte. You were a consultant to that group. How do you think Charlotte has approached this issue and made progress on it?
Well, this kind of goes back to the whole thing that we were just talking about, which is you can elect someone, mayor of a city, an African-American woman, right, who pays attention to these things. And she appointed a legacy commission to consider what the Confederate memorial landscape of Charlotte looked like. And you know, a group of diverse citizens came together on that. I was only a consultant on that, along with Willie Griffin at the Levine Museum, and they made those decisions. And so their recommendations, I think, were really on point, which is, where could we start? You know, we don't have monuments that we have to deal with, but we do have street names. You might have a school name or something like that, but we do have street names. And I think there's an effort underway to change some of those. That was the advice to the city council. So that was a positive way. And then to one of the recommendations was to apply for a grant from the Mellon Foundation to consider how Charlotte might reimagine its memorial landscape. Maybe through art, maybe a monument, I don't know. I think those are very positive approach to this issue in a city the size of Charlotte, which is very diverse.
We've had a long-running debate about discussion, disagreement, however you want to characterize it, about the monument in front of the Gaston County Courthouse. I mean, I know you're not a prognosticator, but just how do you see that playing out, or what's your best guess of what's likely to happen with that?
There's a group there that has an attorney that I think they're going to test. It's going to be a test case. I think they're going to test it against the state constitution, not just the law, but the monument law I'm talking about, but the state constitution. If they are if they are successful in that, you could see a lot of these coming down. And there's also a group of citizens who formed an organization, and that's the goal, to remove monuments from the grounds of courthouses across the state of North Carolina. Again, what has to happen is that they've got to be creative with these cases and see what they can do with them. It'll be interesting to see, but. For example, then you have issues like Burke County recently, where the city council said, let's move it. It's in the city of Morganton, but it sits on ground owned by the county, Burke County, and Burke County says, no, you can't do it. At least people are having discussions.
One of the things that I've been dying to ask you about is what's happening in Asheville, which there is a monument to former Governor Zebulon Vance, who was part of the Confederate Army. And the decision by the local government there is not only to remove, but to destroy every piece of it. Don't auction it off. Don't put it in a museum. Don't do anything. What do you think about that aspect? And do you think we'll see more of that?
That is such an Asheville move, I think. Love it. It's like Asheville is like the rogue city of the state. They're going to do what they want to do. As we were talking about this last night, I was like, it might upset some people, but the way I to put a positive spin on what they're planning to do. I mean, not that that's not positive, by removing something from a space that's shared by all the citizens of Asheville. But it's like, it's just, it's a made of stone from the area. So I'm just like, they're just returning it to the earth that it came from.
So recycling, they're taking care of the environment.
Yeah, they're returning, it came from the ground. It's going back to the ground.
I want to go back to No Common Ground. That reminds me of one of the most intriguing aspects of this whole phenomenon of monuments, which is you write about the business side of monuments, the raising the money, the fact that a lot of times you had materials bought from New York or from Italy, all kinds of places. You had architects, you had designers, you had sculptors. I just think that's such a quintessentially American story that even the winning side, so to speak, for lack of a better term, is still okay with making a buck off these Confederate monuments.
It's called capitalism. Yes. They, we did, there were quarries in the South that that created some of these, but, for people wanted really fine monuments, there were the bronze works were in New York, or the marble, they would order Carrara marble from Italy. They really wanted it. And so, this was, there was a moment in time, and I think these businesses knew that there was a moment. and they're going to cash in on it, because that, you know, it slowly goes away. So, but that they, in that one period of time in the early decades of the 20th century, they were really raking it in.
And you have an advertisement from a company in Georgia that was just sort of I don't know, were they the General Motors of Confederate monuments or something? Yeah. I mean, it's really incredible.
Yeah, the McNeil Marble Company, and they knew what they were doing. They probably understood probably better than any other company that this was not going to last forever. And the UDC were their customers. And they, you know, they also, you know, said, oh, we make monuments for women too. You know, this is not what the women, you know, in the UDC were doing. Their men would put up monuments to the women of the Confederacy. Those are very few. But they basically had them cookie cutter monuments, and they were there. They might, you know, be able to manufacture a different version of that. But they were, you know, they were totally advertising in the Confederate Veteran Magazine, which was going to all these organizations and saying, you know, we've got this for you, and don't wait, you know, don't hesitate, because if your veterans die next week, you know, they won't be able to, you know, enjoy this or appreciate this statue.
Wow. I can only say wow. In our closing seconds, I am curious if you have even a quick thought on how we can teach this better. I know that's a big question, but are there even a couple of ideas?
I think there's a few. I think we do. Education is key. Teaching the truth of history, which is what Harvey Gantt was talking about. I think we, you know, I do what I can beyond my book. My book is for obviously an older audience, but I'm trying to reach younger people with the work that I do. Like I helped to create a TED Ed lesson for young people called Debunking the Lost Cause. That was for probably junior high school. Anytime I get a chance to participate in something like that's like media related, that's directed at young people that can tell this story, that's what I try to do. So there's that aspect. And I actually created some teacher resources for that.
We're at the end of our time. We'll have to have you back. The book is No Common Ground, Dr. Karen Cox, historian at UNC Charlotte. I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.